Entrepreneurs have a problem. They love comparing what they do to waging a war.
In the management literature, it's almost entirely written for peacetime CEOs. On the other hand, right, if you're running out of cash or if you're like Apple when Steve Jobs first took over and they had 3 weeks of cash left and so forth, that's when the wartime techniques come into play.
It's not called rapid growth. It's called blitzscaling. Even our beloved health tech messiah, Eric Topol, wrote a whole book on the creative destruction of medicine. What's with all this aggression? Like, bro, you're building a widget that might be acquired by a large enterprise healthcare incumbent one day, not fighting off the Persians.
This is Sparta!
Whatever happened to gentle disruption?
You have to change it from the inside out, this gentle disruption idea that we hold very close to our hearts in Dr. Doctor. And if you gently disrupt a healthcare system from the inside out so it doesn't even know that it's changing, it doesn't put up antibodies, it actually gets behind the change. And guess what? You can do really great stuff. But people who jump too soon, I think they go with an idea and no proof points. They're just jumping in the pool with everybody else.
Can you talk a little bit more about this gentle disruption idea versus the sort of caricatured move fast and break things concept? And maybe you could even tie it into, I mean, recent health tech failures we've seen in, say, Babylon, Pear, Health IQ. I don't know if you're taking any specific learnings from them or anything comes to mind there.
I mean, there was a bunch of health tech businesses that started in 2012. The class of 2012 was an interesting one. It included us, it included Babylon, it included Huma. There was a whole bunch of us. And we took really different routes. Really, really different routes. And intentionally so. And I have huge respect for Babylon and I have huge respect for Ali. I think he had a vision which was correct. I think he did some amazing stuff. But I never believed that you could blitz scale in healthcare. I just never believed that was the route that would work. And we always took this very intentional option of maintain the equity in the business, go slow, prove the value, gently disrupt. But we always had the same size outcome in our heads at the end. We just thought that the pathway looked different. And that's the joy of entrepreneurship, is that we're all looking at the same mountain and there's like hundreds of different ways up it. You have to pick the one that suits you, and it's only at the end that you know who's chosen the right path. We're not at the end of that journey yet, but I'm really excited to look back in 10 years' time and write the book, because I'm sure there's going to be some interesting case studies, right?
That's Tom Witcher, CEO of Dr. Doctor, who describe themselves as a patient engagement platform, a term which, well, I don't know what it means. Basically, patients use Dr. Doctor to book their appointments as well as receive some care. But again, basically the whole point of this is to reduce DNA rates, did not attend. DNA rates, or when patients don't turn up for their appointments, that really pisses off managers because they can measure it. And also because you're wasting capacity in an often already overburdened healthcare system. So if your startup can fix this, that's a lot of ROI. Tom started Dr. Doctor 10 years ago, and they've had 20 million patients use their platform, recently raising their £10 million Series B round. He's always done things a bit differently. Thanks to Isabel Perrette from Fight or Flight for making this introduction.
So you started with a very specific problem in a specific healthcare system. You started with the problem of patients booking appointments within the NHS. Can you talk to me about maybe the reasoning behind that and in hindsight, whether that was the right approach to go down, going like, let's solve a specific problem really well?
Yeah, I mean, I think with hindsight, a lot of things would have changed. But I've always believed in focus. And one of the interesting things about Dr. Doctor is we bootstrapped our business for the first 7 years. And that was really intentional. You know, I looked at other health tech businesses that raised a lot of money and they weren't necessarily getting sort of a correlated return with the equity that they'd put into their organizations. So we decided to stay like really tightly coupled to a problem that we knew had value. We actually shifted slightly from booking and looked much more at patient engagement as the first part of our product set. So patient engagement wasn't really a thing that people talked about in 2012. And actually now in the UK, it's written into national policy that every organization has to have some sort of patient engagement platform. And the reason that we focused on engagement was really purposeful. As I said, we set out trying to solve the booking problem. But what we discovered when we talked to patient users was, you know what? The issue isn't so much that I can't book an appointment. It's that I don't know why I'm turning up and I'm not sure I value this. And no one's telling me where I am in the queue. So we actually built a lot of our early technology on text messaging. We still send about 20 million text messages a month to patients across the UK. But that engagement step was really, really vital to then being able to build higher value products. And that was always our product strategy. So solve patient engagement, get 60, 70% of patients in an organization using our technology. And then once they've done that, leverage that engaged user base to develop and deploy higher value products. So booking, data collection, remote monitoring, and ultimately moving to a kind of data-based, value-based, value-driven healthcare system. But if you don't get that first step right, the onboarding of patients, the channel shift, their behavior, taking people that are used to using the phone and post and moving them online, none of the other value comes through. So the focus was intentional because it would give us a base on which we could scale everything else.
In creating a sort of patient engagement platform, are there any quirks of human psychology or patient psychology that you must have noted from building that? Are there any strange ways in which people maybe engage better or engage worse based on like little quirks of how you design your product or how you pitch things, anything like that?
There's a lot of that stuff. I mean, we do a huge amount of work on behavioral insights. So everything from the way you word a message to a patient, and actually different people react differently to different types of wording. So ideally, you customize the message based on someone's age or social demographic group or all sorts of different things. You can use nudge. So there's a famous bit of work that the Behavioral Insights Group did, funded by the UK government, looking at if you include the cost of a missed appointment in a text message, it reduces the non-attendance rate by a significant percentage. I think it's like 20%. So adding sort of nudge stuff like that is massive. But then also kind of understanding what it is a patient values in an appointment. So like, are they coming to be told something? Do they feel like they're being checked up on? The time of day makes a really big difference. So if you're a senior citizen and you've got free travel, there's no point booking that person an appointment outside of the free travel times. So an early appointment before the free bus pass kicks in is a total waste of time. And getting that kind of like individual user level knowledge and then being able to apply it to a platform at scale is one of the reasons we've had such a broad success in rolling out what we do.
Have you got any more stuff on this? Because one thing that you talked about reminds me of the Start With Why book. And it's interesting around how you've said the phrasing, what the appointment will cost the health service or what benefit the patient will actually get from it is like an interesting route to go down. It reminds me of the Apple ads back in the day when, you know, Zune were advertising, this is a 2 gigabyte MP3 player, which can play, you know, this MP3 in WAV format. But then Apple just put up an ad saying 1,000 songs in your pocket and immediately you get it, right? So there's something about that. But like, do you have anything more on this piece? Because I think it's really interesting around nudge psychology and getting patients to turn up.
Yeah, I mean, so I've always believed really strongly that if you empower patients so that they are equal partners in their decision making, you get better outcomes. You know, like none of us want to feel like we're a sausage in a sausage factory, right? That is not, that's not helpful. And actually, if you want a patient to have like great recovery or to adhere to whatever treatment routine they've been given, you need to include them from day one, right at the very beginning. And so the fact that most healthcare systems still are very paternalistic in the way that they approach the first interaction you have is a massive challenge. You know, if the first thing you get from your health provider is a letter telling you to turn up at a certain date and time, you're already on the back foot. You have agency taken away from you. So the more agency you can give a patient the sooner, the more likely it is that they're going to engage later on and therefore have a great outcome. So we're really thoughtful about that. We're really thoughtful about how do you make people feel like they have choice, like they're being done with, not to. A lot of that is around wording, but also like when you start thinking about the back end of the appointment journey, so monitoring patients remotely, whether you're doing that in sort of quite low tech ways or whether you're doing that using devices, like actually you want that patient to want to engage with whatever that remote monitoring tool is in a way that is equitable. So if they feel like they've been treated like an adult at the beginning, they're much more likely to treat a kind of a patient-initiated follow-up model, for example, with respect and not abuse that because, hey, guess what? You've treated me like an adult. I'm going to view this like a resource, which I'm going to treat with some scarcity. So I think the whole thing is about treating people like grown-ups, being really clear as to where the value is. It goes for clinicians too, right? So as a clinician, if you sit in an outpatient clinic and you have 10 patients turn up, a lot of them actually probably could have been done asynchronously. And so why see 10 patients for 20 minutes each when you could see two or three patients for half an hour or longer, if you can use some technology to make sure you get the high value patients in first. And again, this is a behavioral thing. If you can manage the risk remotely, if you can keep people informed on both sides as to how that person is adhering to their treatment, you can end up with like much higher value in-person interactions. So it's all linked, right? It's a holistic problem. You can't expect one part of the system to work without like getting it right from day one. That's what we've always believed. And we really focus on that with the way that we roll our technology out.
It's interesting. And I guess the kind of counterforce to that is that when you're building a big organization or thinking in systems levels thinking, there's something about not individualizing stuff too much, keeping or reducing the variance, right? Like if you can keep everything to a 10-minute face-to-face slot where the patient turns up at this time, speaks to reception and comes in, and the doctor has this specific time, you know, 5 minutes history, 5 minutes exam, and then see you later. That on a system level seems to work better, reducing that variance. But maybe that's the bit you've spotted where that on this sort of personal connection level and engagement level, it doesn't perform so well when people feel like they're a sausage in a sausage factory.
Yeah, exactly. And the cool thing about technology like ours is it means, because one of the challenges is that when you try and define a pathway, like standardization is helpful because you don't want everybody with a hernia to have a different route through the hospital. That would just be a nightmare, right? But what you can do using technology is you can understand the intricacies of a particular patient's needs and slightly bespoke the frequency of their interactions. So I personally would much rather have the majority of my interaction online and by text and just come in to see my doctor. I'm going through an allergy pathway at the moment. And to be honest, every single interaction which isn't remote really frustrates me because I'm like, okay, I've got to take half a day off work. And, you know, I'm like, this is rubbish. We could do this better. Whereas I know my dad, for example, who has an autoimmune skin condition, I know that he values those interactions with his clinicians very much. And he will happily travel into London to go to Guy's Hospital to see someone. He doesn't mind. So we have different needs. And the great thing about technology is it allows you to actually standardize a pathway, but then personalize the way that those different patients have different interactions based on their preferences. And so you can actually kind of raise the quality of the interactions for everybody whilst actually reducing the net load on clinical practice, because you know a whole bunch of people are going to go there and do it asynchronously. I'm cool with that. So you can spend longer with the dads who want to have a longer chat.
Absolutely. So Tom, I did warn you that I just ask adversarial questions because I think it's interesting. So the first bit when I see a company like yours solving a problem, like I suppose first criticism I have is that the cohort of patients, I think, who frequently do not attend and like in quotes waste these slots, I would imagine, and they're sometimes characterized as like chaotic patients with like chaotic lifestyles at least. And I do wonder if like a technological innovation would actually work on that group, like basically the biggest offenders, is this the right solution? Because I think on people like ourselves, probably like young professionals, works great. But I do wonder on those groups, are you like actually hitting the chords that are gonna help them? Or do you think it's missing the point there?
I'm gonna split that into two if that's okay. And I don't know, how frequently have you sat on outpatients and is your clinic run late?
So I did 4 months of general practice and I think every single day, every single clinic was late.
Right, they all run late. And the reason they all run late is you have this variability. So some days your DNA rate could be 20% and some days it can be zero. And because you don't know which of those you're going to get, you have to book to an average. And if you book to an average, it means most of the time you're going to have too many patients and most of the time you're going to run late. So if we can reduce the non-attendance, and we've also got some really cool AI which predicts the people who are likely to not come, and I'll talk about that some more in a minute. If you can reduce non-attendance, it allows you to plan and book clinics correctly from day one. So they're much likely to run to time. So you get a better experience. If you combine that then with the AI tools, which are about identifying the specific cohorts who aren't going to come, you can then begin to put some targeted interventions around them. Because you're quite right that there's different people that don't come to appointments. Actually, the highest did not attend rate is in the young professionals.
Right.
So it's so us. I'm totally We're the problem. There. We're the problem. So it's young professionals who are working, who are like, oh man, I forgot, or I just can't take today off work. I've got an important meeting. They're a massive issue. And they respond really, really well to a tech-based solution. You then have a different group of people who are kind of harder to access. And we found SMS works really well for them. So if you're quite transient, move around a lot, maybe you live in a shared house, you probably don't open your post, or your post doesn't get to you before you've moved. And SMS works really well for those people. So Shelter, for example, did a piece of work around homelessness and how do you reach someone who's homeless, who's got, you know, healthcare needs. Well, text messaging is the best way to get hold of those people. They might not have any credit, but they can receive a message. So we try and make our platform work for all of those. And then when we roll the AI into that, so we can give you a clinic list and we can tell you, hey, these are the patients who aren't going to come. You can look at that list and you can decide what you're going to do. If the person at the top of that list is someone who you know, say they have diabetes, they haven't been in for a long time, you know that they're badly controlled, you can get a community diabetes nurse to reach out to them and give them a, you know, a much more bespoke experience, which ultimately saves money because they're not going to turn up in A&E with in DKA. So it's about applying the right technology to the right person.
I guess you've touched on this, but then I think what most other industries seem to do, so airlines come to mind, is the practice of overbooking, book at 105, 110% capacity, assuming 5, 10% DNAs, and that works pretty well. And I'd imagine that healthcare is pretty similar. It would seem to me that if big airlines are doing this, then why do we need to do something different in healthcare? Is there like a specific reason that this doesn't work as well?
I think one of the big things is it's very, very rare that you'll book a flight a year out. Mm. Whereas if you book a follow-up appointment, it's highly likely that it's 6, 8, 12 months in the future. So when that appointment gets booked, you don't know what you're going to be doing on that day. You might not even remember you've got it in 6 months' time. Whereas a flight, you're going on holiday, you book it 3 months in advance, maybe 6 months in advance if you're really organized. If you're me, you do it like 2 weeks before. But so like the booking horizon makes a massive difference. When someone's been booked a year out, they just don't know what they're doing. And then the challenge they have is even if they want to change that date, it can be really hard to change it. Particularly if a hospital is fully booking all of its clinics. Actually, like if you've got a clinical need to follow someone up at 6 months, and 2 weeks before the appointment, they ring up and they go, I can't make it because I've been invited to a wedding. And the next available capacity is another kind of 3 or 4 months out. You actually have a clinical safety problem. So the way that we book appointments has a massive effect on non-attendance. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I guess there's some people who are scared of flying, but like lots of people are actually quite nervous of coming in for their appointment. So DNAs aren't just about people forgetting. They're often about, I don't want to deal with this today. So you often see endoscopy has like super high DNA rates because people wake up and they're like, I don't want bum cam today. I'm not up for this. This is not what I'm about. So actually this problem there is, it goes back to our behavioral point, which is demonstrating that by coming in, they are going to have ultimately a better outcome and making them feel secure and safe and like they have some agency in that. So it's different. I think the last bit is, like the DNA rate on flights is like low, right? It's like single digit percentages. Whereas in the NHS, we have a global average DNA rate of 12%. Really proud to say that in a doctor-doctor hospital, like we're between like 3 and 5%. So quite different in our organizations. But when you're at a 12% DNA rate, like you can't just overbook to solve that problem. Otherwise you end up with late running clinics like we described earlier.
In general, have you found that the carrot or the stick works better for motivating people? Because it comes back to theories of loss aversion, right? Where people, if you tell someone, if you don't do this, you're going to lose £1,000. Or if you tell them alternatively, if you do this, you'll win £1,000. They'll respond much better, or they'll be much more motivated by losing the money. So in general, which one have you found works better, carrot or stick?
Definitely carrot. The stick thing. So in the Netherlands, they charge people. You have a fine if you miss your appointment. And every now and again, it comes round in the papers, you know, oh, we should charge everybody for their missed appointments. They have a stubborn 5% DNA rate. It doesn't go below that in the Netherlands, right? We can get a hospital in the UK to 5% DNA rate really, really easily, just using some simple tech. It doesn't go any lower than that because, as you say, like the kind of the stick stops working. Whereas, and I'm going to sound like a stuck record, I go back to agency. Like making people feel like a valued and equal partner from day one means it's more likely that they're going to come. It means they're more likely that they're going to have a positive interaction with you as a clinician when they turn up. And it means more likely they're going to have a positive outcome. So actually, like, carrots all the way.
The stubborn 5% DNA rate despite charging people in the Netherlands point, I think this links to a study that's mentioned in the original Freakonomics book, which is a psychology study done around, I think it's Israeli nurseries, but essentially, you know, parents are working, they end up coming late to pick their kids up, right? And the nursery thinks this is really annoying, like, why don't we start charging them? And what happens instead is now patients don't even feel guilty about being late because they're paying. So they're like, why not? And actually the late rates get worse. So it's interesting how psychology and human behavior just contradicts itself in so many ways. And I guess you've just got to run the experiments to find out what will work.
You've got to run the experiments. And health is like, because that case study, I think, definitely applies in health as well, right? If someone's being charged for their misappointment, they're like, oh, that's cool. That doesn't matter so much.
And it's only £5 and it justifies it in your head, right?
Yeah, suddenly, okay, there's a give and a take here. I've even noticed it with the school fines, right? Like, you get fined if you take a kid out of school these days. And suddenly you hear people talking about, okay, there's a balance here, so the school fine's this, but the extra cost of the flights is that. It becomes an economic equation rather than like, hey, my kid should be in school because they should be learning. I think that's fascinating. But you're right, it comes back to the experiments. And I think that's the key to all of this is people don't always do what you expect them to do. So being able to run rapid iterations and A/B tests across different clinical settings is really important, because also somebody treats a 2-week wait oncology clinic differently to how they treat a physio appointment. That's just a fact they do. People have a different, they have a different fear factor going into it. So you have to personalize and customize the experience around all of that as well. And that's one of the cool things about the Dr. Dr. platform, is because we have such a high volume of interactions on it now. You know, we're doing tens of millions a month, and the system is super configurable and granular. We're constantly running small experiments, you know, like either like a specialty level or a hospital level, even at a locality level, just trying to work out, okay, what can we change here that reduces the friction for the patient, makes it easier for them to access the information they need, and ultimately save some money and save some time.
You should get some people from the behavioral unit or Daniel Kahneman or someone like that to run some interesting experiments, because you'd have some really cool data.
Yeah, we really should. I talk to the behavioral insights guys lots, actually, because we have got this. I think that we have got this amazing resource in the platform that we could leverage in all sorts of ways around that. There's never enough time in the day. This is the problem, right?
All right, Tom. I think this conversation's become too nice. So just to add some more criticism. I got this skeptical take, and it's not just my take, I think many people have it, but specifically in a socialized healthcare system, that friction in booking appointments and follow-ups, etc., it exists for a reason, and that reason is to temper demand or control demand in some way. The very, very clear example of this we see is that in primary care, in GP, the only way most people in the UK can get an appointment is calling at 8 a.m. and sitting in a queue, maybe for 30 minutes, eventually getting through to a receptionist who tells you, sorry, mate, no appointments today, try again tomorrow. And that's the only purpose of that, right? It's because they're overrun. They need to create some kind of friction in the process. So my skeptical take becomes that perhaps the reason innovations or things like Dr. Dr. don't exist is not because we don't have the technology or we don't have the people with amazing ideas. It's because the system or the man or whatever sort of nebulous bad person there is doesn't want it to exist. What do you make of that?
I think the more time you spend working in any complex environment, particularly in health, the more you realize that there is no big conspiracy, because no one has got control enough over it to come up to like manage that sort of thing, right? If anybody like could pull off a stunt like that, then you know it'd be very different. So I don't think there is a big conspiracy. I do think, particularly at the front door, people are trying to make sure that they manage demand. I think that is true. What I think is really interesting is there is latent demand out there for healthcare services, right? Like, there are people who aren't being seen that should be seen. And the great thing about a socialized healthcare system, where the payer and provider are one, is actually like there is incentives to invest in prevention, because that person who can't get a GP appointment, if they leave whatever it is too long, they end up turning up at A&E as an emergency admission. And guess what? That costs a lot more money than it would have just to see them early on and have solved that problem at the front door. So the system that we work under is incentivized actually to make sure people do get access right at the start because it costs less ultimately. Now, the reality, as we know, is that those incentives aren't lined up on the ground, and the GP doesn't mind if the patient goes to A&E because they're not paying for it currently. But as we've moved now to integrated care systems, which do have sight of the cost of providing care for a single patient across a locality, I think we're going to see more of that sort of stuff. And we're going to see commissioners thinking about how do they put incentives in place to make sure that everybody gets access earlier, which is really positive and is a big shift towards a much more value-based care model, which I think is exciting. And I think the NHS has an opportunity to lead the world in terms of delivering true value-based care. I think it's the, you know, you talk to anybody, you know, we've all read Porter's book, right? You know, but that was written in the early 2000s. 20 years later, value-based care still isn't a reality, but every single conference up and down the Western world certainly is talking about VBC. And I think the NHS could grapple that and show the world what good looks like from a value-based care point of view because we have an integrated payer provider. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that as when I speak to clinicians about freeing up booking, they actually get more worried about follow-ups. So often when it comes to patient-initiated follow-up booking models, clinicians say to me, oh yeah, but if I allow patients to book, they're going to be a nightmare. They're going to be in every single week talking to me. And we've actually seen the opposite. So I'll give you a couple of statistical examples. So at Nottingham, we moved to a monitored, admittedly, but a monitored patient-initiated follow-up model in oncology services. We saw a 60% reduction in face-to-face.
Sorry, so that means that instead of when the patient has the appointment, they automatically get booked for their follow-up in 6 months. Instead, they are completely left to their own devices to book the follow-up themselves using some kind of link. Is that right?
Yeah, so this was a monitored one, so it was slightly different. So they were getting a monthly, it might have been weekly actually, a weekly PROM, basically, patient recorded outcome measure survey, and they filled that out. And if they went out of range on that PROM, then they were prompted to book an appointment. But at any point during the journey, they always had the option to free book into a link as well.
Got you.
So that's one example. Another example is dermatology services. So in dermatology services in Liverpool, we saw a 91% reduction in face-to-face follow-up appointments by initiating a PIFU model. And it works really well as well in like chronic conditions like rheumatology, diabetes, et cetera, where if you have well-controlled patients, actually you just say to them, look, you know what's going on with you. I'm here when you need me. And I think it's more nuanced than just have a link and book. It's important to provide like the form, the PROMS-based monitoring works really well because it's like a safety net on both sides. But that those sort of models are really interesting. And when you first roll them out, you always get the challenge of, are people just going to abuse this? But the opposite is true. People really, really treat it like a scarce resource and only use it when they need to, which takes us back to empower people, give them agency, treat them like adults, and you get a better outcome all through the journey.
That's super interesting because I would have guessed the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Tom, let me ask you a really difficult, sort of unpopular question, which is that, I mean, you're clearly like a good person, right? And you've got this piece around building everything so it's patient focused and just making it better for the real people dealing with healthcare, right? At a difficult time in their lives, probably. So that's awesome. And you've got this piece around agency and just how if you empower people and treat them like adults, totally agree with that, that actually good things happen. Like who would have guessed, right? But are there any things that you've come across in your healthcare or building this company experience where you think that approach doesn't apply? Where, and let me just give an example. So where the more traditional sort of paternalistic approach of treating people like soldiers, like this is what you need to do. You need to be here at this time. You've got no choice, for example. But are there any pieces, and it's fine if no, but are there any pieces where when you've been in this business, you've been like, actually this sort of new, I don't want to call it a trend, but like almost like frame shift in how we approach medicine, this doesn't really work here.
That is a great question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before. I don't think I've ever seen that on a system level. I think there are individuals in the system who respond better to that and want to be told where to go, just to turn up, you know, and are happy for that. They do exist for sure. I've met them. I'm sure you've met them too. And they don't want the complexity. They don't really want to be offered the choice. You know, they're the sort of people that when you go out for dinner, they just want you to choose for them. Those people exist for sure, right? But if you scale it up to like even a clinic level, no, I don't think so. I think this is better for everybody. We just have to remember that different people have different preferences, and to, when we design our products and platforms, to design with everybody, you know, in mind. So for example, I use the word hybrid, you know, hybrid healthcare rather than digital first healthcare, because whenever we design something, we make sure there's a phone option, there is a post option, there is a face-to-face option, because for some people that is better. You have to think about the whole problem, not just the digital part, otherwise you exclude people. So at a system level, I think no. At an individual person level, you've got to design for everybody and their needs.
Yeah, I remember seeing a patient like straight, like fresh out of med school. And I think there was a decision basically around a few drugs they could start treating, like a long-term condition they had. And I gave them all the pros and cons and was like, well, this one's better because of this, this one's... And they just looked at me with this like WTF sort of face, like, well, which one do I take?
Yeah.
And yeah, yeah. That was just, they didn't like that. That was like, it almost like inspired like didn't inspire confidence in me that I was giving so many options. It was like, well, you're the doctor. So it's interesting. You're right. Have there been any habits or ways you approach problems or ways you think that you think have helped you get to where you are today? Like any special sauce?
That's a good question. I mean, I think an open-minded approach to the problem space is key. I still think in healthcare, people building products don't spend enough time with the users. It amazes me, actually, how many health tech businesses are being built by product managers that are sat in offices in cities. I used to have this thing, which was, I'm going to try and collect every single like mini train station in the country, because I believe if you get on the train and you go and see a customer, you're going to learn something. So my number one in my framework is get out there and go and visit people in person. You can't do enough of it in health. It's endemic still that people don't do that. So that's number one. Number two is like, be really clear on the outcome, but be sort of weakly opinionated on the journey. Because as you go down, like we thought we were going to build an app to book outpatient appointments. We built a text message based engagement platform initially. You know, we solved the problem, but we went about it in a totally different way. Never optimize too soon. Make sure that the first versions, people like the MVP thing is really interesting in healthcare because there is the bar is quite high. But you should still, like I love the Airbnb example of the founders going and taking photos of units themselves. You know, we did a lot of that sort of stuff. I remember like we literally like faked the automation in the background by just replying to messages to see if patients would engage initially. It was literally just Steve in the background, one of our developers replying to messages to just test if it worked. And that gave us the confidence to write some code. And then I personally, like being a founder is a really emotional journey. It has ups and downs. It's a roller coaster. I think it's why we do it, right? We're addicted to both. For healthcare, you have to have a long-term horizon. And for me, the mission has always been that. I am like so motivated by the thought that we're actually making a difference to patients every day that allows me to motor through the painful bits. And there's lots and lots of painful bits. There's bits where you want to scream and throw your laptop out of the window because the system's being so useless. But that kind of long-term, we're making a difference. This is going to fundamentally act. It's not going to just help, you know, the person on the street, but it will help my parents, it will help my brother, it will help my sister if we can improve the NHS. That gets me out of bed and it gets me through the challenges of working with a slower kind of enterprise-y type organization like the NHS is.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening.